Tuesday night was one for the history books. Senator Bernie Sanders made mincemeat out of the polls, nearly all of which had Secretary Hillary Clinton winning by double digits in Michigan. Republican frontrunner Donald Trump showed his momentum was not slowed in Michigan. The big winner? Democracy. Record numbers turned out to vote all across the state. So many, in fact, some places ran out of ballots. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, what we learn from the Michigan primary. But first, the U.S. Senate has given unanimous approval to a funding bill, including important protections for the Great Lakes. That bill ties Great Lakes protections to funding for the agency that is the federal regulator of pipelines. Democratic Senator Gary Peters is co-sponsor of the bill, and he is with us now. Before we get into the pipeline bill, Senator Peters, what is your reaction to Senator Bernie Sanders defying the pundits and the polls and getting that upset win over Hillary Clinton in Michigan?
Well, it is something, and I think what the real story coming out of the primary was just the incredible turnout. You know, we set a record that we haven't seen for a long time, a great deal of enthusiasm from voters in Michigan, both on the Republican and the Democratic side. And it was great to see Michigan primary having such a central role in the process. Usually our primaries are late. Nominees have already been determined. That certainly wasn't the case last night. Michigan was in the center of the debate, and the eyes of the country were on Michigan, and the people of the state of Michigan turned out in mass.
And how surprised were you personally at the result?
I always thought it would be close, although I thought Secretary Clinton was going to win. But certainly, I think the other big story is the polls were very wrong. They had Hillary Clinton ahead by a very large percentage, and she ended up losing by a small percentage. So it was quite a turnaround. I expected her to win, although I thought it would be closer than what the polls were saying. But certainly was surprised, like many people, that Bernie ended up winning.
Let's turn to your bill, the pipelines bill. What does it do, Senator?
Well, the bill that passed deals with the reauthorization of PHMSA, which is the federal agency that oversees pipelines across the country, oil pipelines. I've been able to insert language that will make sure that pipes in the Great Lakes region receive the highest possible scrutiny, the toughest regulations. It will classify all pipelines in the Great Lakes as a high-consequence pipeline. Particularly important given what we saw in Kalamazoo and the catastrophic pipeline break there that is now the most expensive pipeline break in history, over $1 billion in cleanup. And we have a number of other very vulnerable areas, the Straits of Mackinac, but not to mention all of the other pipes that crisscross various tributaries to the Great Lakes. And the Great Lakes are not only an important resource from a recreational standpoint and a commercial standpoint, but also the source of drinking water for over 40 million people. We need to make sure that we have the toughest standards in place. That's what this legislation will do. In addition to looking at things such as cleanup plans and requiring that they actually consider ice cover, which surprisingly enough was not part of plans in the past. And when you have the Great Lakes, that can be completely frozen over. The Straits of Mackinac can be completely frozen over. It is very, very difficult to clean up a spill should that occur during ice cover. And we're now going to require folks to consider that. And if they can't clean something up, they probably shouldn't be operating during those times.
So this bill's putting the onus on pipeline operators to up their safety standards and do better with their oil spill response plans. But it also puts it on the government to do a better job of reviewing the pipeline's age and integrity, which I think everyone in Michigan who's casting a nervous eye at Enbridge Line 5 under the Straits wants to hear that, because there's concern about the fact these are 62-year-old pipelines.
Absolutely, and that's another key part of the legislation is to take a look at aging pipelines and how age can severely impact the integrity of these pipes. As you mentioned, Enbridge, over 60 years old. We have a couple of pipes now that are in review. We're trying to get back a comment period in the St. Clair River that are 98 years old. It certainly, I think, highlights the fact that we've got a very aging infrastructure, and as infrastructure ages, the risk of catastrophic failure goes up. We have to be in a mode where we are starting to replace these lines. If we're going to continue to operate them, they need to be replaced with new state-of-the-art technology. The risk is simply too great for us to assume.
And I am glad you brought up those 98-year-old pipelines running under the St. Clair River between Marysville and Sarnia. We spoke with someone from a water group who's very, very concerned that the public comment period was up before people found out about this request, the owner asking to update usage permits because it was buried in the Federal Register. Is this on your radar screen, and can you report anything?
It is, and it was certainly unacceptable that you have a comment period that no one knows about, and it comes up and then disappears before you can actually get that. We have written letters and requesting that the federal government reopen that comment period. I'm going to continue to press that issue. The folks need to have a say, and certainly I'm very concerned about these pipes myself, and are going to be doing everything we can to get that comment period open up again and make sure we've got a thorough review here. But it's certainly very troubling.
Senator, back to the bill, the fact that it was unanimously passed by the Senate, what does that tell us? Could that bode well for the reception in the House?
It should bode very well. We are expecting it to be able to move in a bipartisan way through the House as well. It's always nice to get unanimous consent, particularly given what happens in Congress. Folks know that there's a lot of difficult issues we deal with. We're difficult to find consensus, but in this case, we were able to get broad consensus, everybody on board, Democrats and Republicans passing this legislation. So we're hoping to have fast action in the House.
We're talking with Democratic Senator Gary Peters. And Senator, I'd like to touch on that $100 million funding package for Flint that you and Senator Debbie Stabenow proposed. And we're hearing now that Utah Republican Senator Mike Lee has put a hold on that package and calling it political grandstanding. What's happening here?
Well, Senator Lee does have a hold. He's got a couple issues related to it. We're hopeful we're going to be able to work that through with him. I had a discussion with him yesterday, and I believe that we're close to having a resolution. It's just critical to move it forward. We do have strong bipartisan support for this as well. Many Republican co-sponsors who are on the legislation, have worked with members across the aisle. That's why it's so disappointing that we just have one senator who is holding it up, because that's does not represent the support we have here in the Senate. And we're confident if we get it on the floor for a vote, we will be able to pass it.
Gary Peters, Democratic senator from the state of Michigan. Great talking with you, Senator Peters. Thanks so much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Detroit Public Schools emergency manager Judge Stephen Rhodes and the new interim superintendent Alicia Merriweather were in Lansing today, testifying before a state House committee. Michigan Public Radio Network's Lansing reporter Jake Neer is with us now. What was today's hearing about, Jake?
Well, it was one in a series of hearings that we've had on these bills in the House. And so it was just continuing, sort of more of a dialogue on what's in the bills, what can be done to help Detroit Public Schools from running out of money next month. I think the big news today, of course, came from the new emergency manager, or transition manager, as he's calling himself, Judge Stephen Rhodes, who oversaw the city's bankruptcy. He's been asked to step in and try to solve the issues with DPS. So, he hammered a lot of really interesting points about where the district is financially now and what needs to happen from here to really solve the problem.
And how quickly does it need to happen?
April 8th will be the last day that employees of DPS can expect to get paid. There were estimates that it would be later in the month that the school district would actually run out of money. But Rhodes said to reporters afterwards that, "I cannot in good conscience ask teachers to come in and work if we're not going to pay them." So April 8th has become the deadline at this point. And that's also not the deadline for the legislature to get something done on this, because the legislature is not in session until April 8th. They really have 2 weeks to do something about this if Stephen Rhodes has his way.
And this House plan for the DPS, it is pretty tough on Detroit teachers, including taking away collective bargaining. What did Judge Rhodes and Superintendent Merriweather say about that?
Well, this sort of fits into a narrative that they're really trying to hammer here, that teachers really deserve a lot more respect than what they've been getting, that more than pay, more than more compensation, teachers really just want respect out of this process. And they also mentioned that, you know, we're facing a major teacher shortage in Detroit Public Schools, and the bills in the House, as they're written right now, would do things like reduce collective bargaining rights. They would reduce retirement benefits for new teachers. They didn't say directly that these things were bad, but what they said is, we really hope that lawmakers, especially in the House, will keep this in mind, this teacher shortage, and giving teachers respect as we move forward.
Jake, there are a lot of differences between the Senate version of an overhaul plan and the House version. How realistic is it really to think that this is all going to be nailed down within 2 weeks?
Well, the core of this is the same in both chambers. The difference is that the House has added all these really controversial measures into the equation. But really what we are talking about right now as the thing that needs to happen, if, again, the governor and Judge Rhodes have their way, and that is the bailout portion of this, is just making sure that DPS does not run out of money, that the state sends that support before April 8th, when, again, Rhodes says he can't pay employees anymore.
Clock is ticking. Michigan Radio's Lansing reporter Jake Neer, thanks so much for the update, Jake.
Oh, thank you, Cindy.
Coming up, saluting America's first African-American woman physician.
She was derided by her colleagues. Pharmacists would not fill her prescriptions. And some said, oh, well, Rebecca's MD stands for mule driver.
And then in 10 minutes, evolving our way to artificial intelligence. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When you walk through the corridors of a hospital or a clinic, you don't think twice about seeing African-American women who are physicians. But that idea was once unthinkable. That is, until Rebecca Davis Lee Crumpler took on the medical establishment and won. University of Michigan medical historian and PBS NewsHour contributor Dr. Howard Markell is here now to tell us about the nation's first African-American woman physician. And this is the 121st anniversary of the death of this very remarkable woman.
Yes.
But we don't know a lot about her.
No, and she didn't leave a lot behind. Her name is Rebecca Davis, and she grew up in Pennsylvania. An aunt reared her, and her aunt was a nurse of sorts who took care of other African-American neighbors. You know, the care, the medical care for African-Americans pre-Civil War and even post-Civil War was not all that great. And so Rebecca learned from her aunt, and she also got admitted to an exclusive private school in Newton, Massachusetts as a special student. So she was well educated, which also made her quite different from her peers. And she moved to Charleston, Massachusetts in about 1852 and took up nursing, but she wanted more. And so in 1860, she applied to the New England Female Medical College.
So there was such a thing,
yeah,
even pre-Civil War.
Yeah, just for women.
Just then.
Just for women.
Just for women. And I'm sure it wasn't well received by the medical establishment.
Well, on many levels, the people who founded this female medical college were two men, and their male colleagues derided it. They said, you know, women are not strong enough to take on the rigors of medicine. And a lot of the topics are not meant for their sensitive ears. You know, we said that even here at the University of Michigan in 1870 when we began accepting women students to the medical school.
Boy, oh boy. So how did things fare for her? Was she able to practice medicine once she graduated?
She was. She married a man named Lee in 1852, but he died while she was in medical school. And then she married another man named Crumpler in 1864 upon her graduation. Both of them moved to Virginia after the war, after the Civil War ended in 1865, because don't forget, this is when the Freedmen's Bureau started.
True.
Yeah, this is the federal agency that was going to help, you know, millions of slaves transition from bondage to freedom.
So certainly medical care would have been a part of that.
And medical care was part of that. And she wanted to go because that was where she was most needed. That is where she could take care of the patients most in need and, in fact, help her people transition from this just stunning situation from point A to B is not such a quick line.
Virtually overnight.
Yes.
But it strikes me that being an African-American woman in Virginia was probably not an easy path path to walk for her.
It was not easy. She was derided by her colleagues. Pharmacists would not fill her prescriptions. And some said, oh, well, Rebecca's MD stands for mule driver. So she had to put up with a lot of guff, a lot of prejudice, a lot of angst every day, and she paid it no mind. She focused on the job at hand and took care of her patients.
And then what? After that immediate post-war, she kind of had a life of medicine to
Yeah, around 1869, after the Crumplers finished their work there, they moved back to Boston. They settled in Beacon Hill, which we think of as really a posh place,
but
parts of it were an African-American neighborhood. And there they both practiced for a while until 1880, when they moved, of all places, to Hyde Park, New York.
Did they?
And she probably stopped practicing. We don't have a lot of materials about her life at this point. But she did write a wonderful book called A Book of Medical Discourses in Two Parts. It was published in 1883. And it's probably, as I say, I always hate to say the first, but it's probably the first medical text written by an African American.
And do I understand that she didn't even necessarily realize that she was the first African-American woman physician?
No. And you think about it. I mean, there were, even in 1865, there's maybe out of many tens of thousands of physicians, there's maybe 100 or 200 women physicians, and none of them were black until she graduated. Another woman got that credit. She graduated in 1867, and her name was Dr. Rebecca Cole. By the way, the statistics are quite stunning. In 1860, there were only 300 women out of 54,543 physicians in the United States, and none of them were African American. But this other woman, Rebecca Cole, got the credit, even though she graduated a few years later, from the Women's Medical College of Pennsylvania, which was in Philadelphia for many years, an all-women's medical school. So our Rebecca probably did not know of that status. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until the last 20 or 30 years that historians started delving into the story and giving her her due credit.
Yeah, I'm kind of wondering why she's so poorly acknowledged when she was such a groundbreaker, even that it took this long to kind of get a sense of who that first person was, because she truly was a game changer.
Well, you know, I think it's an interesting comment on how history is recorded, particularly up to the last couple of decades. The history of African Americans was not emphasized in the history books 30 or 40 years ago, and the study was not emphasized. And as more and more specialists started to delve into these topics about a great many people who are not recorded, we've learned so much more, and we have realized that our history is far more diverse, far richer than we ever thought.
When you walk the halls of any hospital, it certainly is clear a lot has changed in the 120 years since the death of Rebecca Davis Lee Crumpler, the very first African-American woman physician in the nation.
And thank goodness for that.
Indeed. Dr. Howard Markell, University of Michigan medical historian and PBS NewsHour contributor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you miss Stateside on the radio, it's easy to catch us on iTunes. Search for Stateside. While you're there, please give us a review. We'd really like to hear what you think. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Artificial intelligence is a subject that has long inspired the imagination of just what our future as humans on Earth might look like. Earlier today in Seoul, South Korea, our glimpse into that future just got a little bit clearer. In what's considered a major advance in artificial intelligence, Google's AlphaGo computer program bested the world's top player of a complex board game called Go. That news today supports the view of Michigan State University biologist and computer scientist Arend Hinz. He believes artificial intelligence is not something for the distant future. In fact, he thinks artificial intelligence, AI, can become a reality perhaps in his lifetime. We reached Professor Hinz via Skype. Professor, before we talk about the path to developing artificial intelligence, let me start with a very, very basic question. What is artificial intelligence?
Oh, that's an excellent question. And quite frankly, the founding founders of AI, like Alan Turing and those people, thought about this really deeply. What is intelligence and what is artificial intelligence? And they come up with something called the Turing test. And the Turing test means that you talk to the AI and you make up your mind about this being a program or this being human like or as much of a human as it can be. And that's pretty much sort of, you know, the onset of artificial intelligence research and what they thought about it.
Was that, are we talking about the late 40s and into the 50s?
Yes. That's sort of, you know, after Turing hacked the Enigma in World War II, he pretty much started thinking about these concepts. And then there are lots of other people from Neumann and other researchers that really thought about using computers to, you know, mimic you and me, so to speak. That was their idea.
So I'm wondering, as I think about where we are now, certainly we've seen headlines such as when IBM's computer Deep Blue beat chess master Garry Kasparov. And I certainly remember IBM's supercomputer Watson when it beat Jeopardy champs Ken Jennings and Brad Rutter. Is that what you think about when you think of artificial intelligence?
Well, I mean, this is a very significant step towards computational thinking and so forth. But quite frankly, this is actually not what I think Turing, or at least I, really had in mind when we thought about this. Because these machines that you see, I mean, Deep Blue particularly, is absolutely awesomely brilliant at playing chess. And then that's it, right? Mm-hmm. And I mean, Watson can play Jeopardy and win lots and lots of money. Watson wouldn't know what to do with the money, or if there's a fire in the building, Watson would just burn. So what we have here, what current research is doing, is single-purpose machines that are exceptionally good at this one purpose. And quite frankly, you and I, we are not single-purpose machines. We are multi-purpose machines. We are really good at many, 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 many things. We can also adapt ourselves. We have consciousness. We have feelings, emotions, all of this. And this is really different from what we currently see as the hallmark of AI research.
You had a comment or a line that I read that you wrote, that intelligence is not engineered, it's evolved. So can that apply to artificial intelligence? Because doesn't it have to be engineered?
Well, I mean, when we actually build something, then we engineer it, right? And the question is, what do we do in order to get that done? And if you think about, you know, you sitting down or I sitting down and writing a little computer program that is supposed to be artificially intelligent, well, I mean, we're trying this for 70 years and can't get it done. And at the same time, we have an amazing precedence of artificial intelligence, or actually real intelligence, and that is humans run around and they're actually evolved. So the idea is, instead of sitting down and writing computer programs, well, we should harness the power of evolution and evolve them. That is pretty much what I try to pursue in my research.
Okay, so are you basically trying to find a way for a digital brain to evolve the way a human brain does?
This is exactly it. And the real reason for that is that I know that evolution did it already. So why not try to figure out how evolution did it and then reuse this to actually come to artificial intelligence?
How do you do this then? Give us an idea of, because this is absolutely fascinating, the idea that that's what you're following along. How are you exploring ways for that digital brain to evolve?
So this is also sort of, you know, a field or a game changer when you start doing this, because when you try to program something or you're really interested in how code works, well, then suddenly all your collaborators are computer scientists and engineers. And when you do what I do, trying to figure out how evolution evolved intelligence, then suddenly all your collaborators are cognitive scientists, behavioral biologists, psychologists, people that are sort of more interested in the organism rather than in the abstract process. So what we are doing in most of my work is we look at, let's say, a particular cognitive ability that's either decision-making or foraging, navigation, swarming, all these hallmarks of behavior that you see. And then what we design is, we design a world in which that particular behavior is good. So if we talk about foraging, for example, that is looking for food, we have a fairly complicated environment in which we put food cubes that have to be collected, and we basically reward agents, meaning little organisms that run around in this world and collect the food, by how well they actually do this. And now that we have a feedback mechanism that tells us how well they perform, well, we can select the ones that are better, let them make copies, mutate the copies, and keep this process running until we have many generations accumulated. Over time, their performance gets better, very much identical to what evolution does.
Do you really believe that within your lifetime we will see artificial intelligence, as we're talking about it, become reality?
So, I mean, I'm absolutely sure that we have artificial intelligence right now. It's not very smart yet. So the real question is if we get human-level intelligence or something that is least comparable in certain degrees. And that is really limited on two questions. The first thing is, do we have enough computational resources? And can we comprehend evolution and evolutionary mechanics faster than we can actually understand how brains work from a neuroscience point of view. I mean, there are other sciences that try to understand human level intelligence or behavior, and technically we would be able to reverse engineer this until once we know how this is working. So we pretty much have this race between cognitive science research and evolutionary research on this end of the spectrum.
And each is going to help the other. What uses do you see? If you let your mind run free and you think about getting this human level artificial intelligence, how could we use it?
Well, I mean, first of all, you have a surrogate for humans, right? That means that everything that we can do, you could let an android do. I mean, there are two things. It's first of all, the mind and the brain having the ability to make decisions and to have thoughts and so forth. And then on top of that, we also have to build machines that actually can do something in the world. And let's assume that you can build robots and engineering finds out how to do that. Mm-hmm. We can put artificial brains into them and then let them control by these controllers, then really everything that humans can do, you can let a robot do. That's the whole idea.
And I guess I have to ask, is this something to be hopeful about or fearful about? Or both?
Well, I mean, there's one other very interesting question to solve, and that is, in the long run, if you have a machine that has human-level intelligence, we kind of also think that it's a human-level consciousness. And then what you're suddenly talking to is not a can opener or a coffee machine. It's another sentient being. And then you cannot just command it around. It actually has very, very deep ethical and moral implications. But at the same time, we all are humans ourselves, and we can actually negotiate pretty well that you do your job, I do my job, and it's not much of a problem. So ultimately, once we have intelligent machines, we pretty much have to have a negotiation about what they do, what we do, how we can profit from each other, how there's synergy, and so forth.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the scene in Stanley Kubrick's 2001 when Hal said, "No, I'm not going to open that pod door for you." So he was ahead of the human.
So I mean, Hal, on top of everything, actually got crazy. That's actually a very scary thought, I think. But at the same time, Hal is also not an evolved being. Hal is pretty much something that epitomizes code and design, right? There were programmers that, I mean, at least that's how I interpret it. It's a movie after all, right?
Sure, sure.
But I think the way Kubrick envisioned this is that there are lots and lots of programmers that write a very, very complicated program that also has conflicting instructions. And that's why Hal goes crazy and sacrifices the crew for the benefit of achieving the mission. And that's something that you and I wouldn't do. We would actually rationalize this entire situation and come up with much better solutions than having conflicting instructions. I mean, we are really good in dealing, first of all, with missing information, but also in estimating situations like, oh, does this thing make more sense than the other? And I think Hal was never programmed to make these types of decisions. So Hal not being an evolved AI is pretty much the worst possible case of artificial intelligence that you can imagine. Yeah. And at the same time, I mean, if you think about intelligence made humans, and we are really good at agreeing with each other and sorting our problems, and we are pretty much also not scared of other humans. So why should we be scared of artificial intelligence that is evolved?
I would say some might argue that we're really, really good at agreeing with each other, but I think that gets into other kind of questions too.
Sure, but I mean, I think the thing is that generally we think this. And also, I mean, if you think about humans actually committing crimes or being in horrible situations or doing wars, then it's either due to hate or due to limited resources or to other very, very negative circumstances. We would not think that in a society where everything is healthy, everything is fine, we would necessarily have these conflicts.
Aaron Hintz is a Michigan State University biologist and computer scientist working on ways of evolving our way to artificial intelligence. Thanks so much for sharing your work with us, Aaron.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
We'd always like to hear from you. It is an open invitation. Tell us what stories you're focused on or issues you want to hear more about. You can find us on Facebook, search for Stateside. We're also on Twitter at Stateside Radio, and as always at michiganradio.org. Still to come, our It's Just Politics team fills us in on what they're thinking about after Michigan's primary.
I mean, this is just one of the greatest pulling upsets, and it just shows this momentum that maybe we in the media have not been doing the best job of keeping an eye on and relying on this idea that the Clintons and their ability to get out urban votes, you know, did they take it for granted?
Plus, we'll look at the process of just what it takes to get a federal disaster declaration. It's a big question in Flint. That comes up in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Pollsters and pundits across the nation were stunned by the results of Michigan's Democratic primary. Even though Hillary Clinton had won every single poll taken over the last month, Bernie Sanders beat her in Michigan. Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta are with us now. And Rick, I saw the political blog 538 saying, well, I'm eating a big stack of humble pie. He's calling the Sanders win in Michigan, I'm quoting him, one of the greatest upsets in modern political history. Do you agree, Rick?
Yes, it is. And we should point out that that wasn't the revered Nate Silver who wrote that piece,
right,
but another writer for 538 blog.
Yeah, Harry Anton.
Yeah. You know, what 538 typically does is aggregate polls and then comes up with a statistical probability of who's going to win. And the aggregate of polls showed a 99% chance of Hillary Clinton winning. We know that Bernie Sanders staged an upset, but Zoe, who would you say the big losers were last night?
The pollsters.
The pollsters.
Yes.
And it was across the board. It was in-state polling firms, out-of-state polling firms.
That we're just talking 2 to 3%, you know, 2 or 3 points. I mean, we're talking
double
about
digits.
Polls, double digits, mm-hmm. Some that had her at like 22 points ahead, which I think we all didn't think it was going to be that close. But I think probably had, you know, she won by double digits, we all would have been like, yeah, sure, that's what the poll said. And so, I mean, this really is, as that quote says, I mean, this is just one of the greatest polling upsets. And it just shows this momentum that maybe we in the media have not been doing the best job of keeping an eye on and relying on this idea that the Clintons and their ability to get out urban votes, you know, did they take it for granted?
Well, you know, when we're talking about the polling, one of the things that I wonder what might have gone wrong, and this is just a theory on my part, but pollsters sometimes have what Nate Silver calls a house bias. They just sort of, for whatever reasons, their methods are naturally weighted toward a particular candidate. And I just wonder if there was just such widespread belief in the power and competence of the Clinton operation that there was a built-in house bias to just sort of weight things in the direction of Hillary Clinton.
And maybe voters are sick and tired of polls telling them how they're supposed to behave. They're like, I'm just going to do what I want. Stop telling me these, because there's such a flood, nonstop polls.
That's true. But I guess my question would then be, how would those two things connect? How do they play together?
Well, don't tell me to vote for Hillary, because I'm going to go in and do what I want. And they did. And by the way,
so are you saying that you think that people are lying to pollsters?
Maybe. I don't know. It just seems that there is kind of a sense of stop telling us what we're going to do. I mean, I want my voice to be heard when I step into the ballot box, and I'll make my decision then.
Well, Cindy, and as you and I have been talking about for a while now, you could have that same narrative and jump over to the Republican side and talk about Trump. And
then, yes,
you know, Mitt Romney came out last week with this, you know, fiery speech, at least fiery for Mitt Romney. You know, this anybody but Trump. And yet, you know, there was then some folks going, hey, did that only, you know, make Trump stronger? That here is the former candidate, the establishment candidate, some might say, mm-hmm. saying don't vote for Trump. And if anything, did that make people even want to come out more?
Because we know Trump supporters want an outsider.
Well, I think it was pretty plain that Romney was speaking for the establishment, and Trump voters are basically anti-establishment. But here's the other thing about that, which is that the polls basically got Trump and Cruz and Kasich
Correct. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So why the disconnect just in the Democratic primary?
Mm-hmm. And that mm-hmm. is really, we don't have an answer for that, do we?
Mm, no.
And knowing that Michigan, boy, they stepped it up. We had more than 2.5 million votes cast yesterday, and that breaks the mm-hmm. old record set back in 72. And I will date myself. That was my first election. And George McGovern running against Richard Nixon, and we young voters were really invested in that election because of the Vietnam War. So did these young voters sway this as they stepped up and said, we're voting for Bernie?
It would seem so. And it would seem that Hillary Clinton might have done herself a favor by maybe spending a little less time in Detroit in particular, where she and her husband and her daughter really, really worked that city.
They did.
And maybe spend a little bit more time like Bernie Sanders on college campuses.
And yet when you look at Wayne County and you look at the city, they also didn't do as well there as some mm-hmm. of the polling would suggest, too. So who knows? Maybe, yes, they could have gone to the East Lansings, the Ann Arbors, the Kalamazoos more. But then would that have taken away from the time? Because they barnstormed Detroit this past weekend. I mean, the former president, Hillary, Chelsea Clinton, all over that city. So then you go, okay, that's how much time and energy that took. And they still didn't quite meet, you know, expectations.
Also, Bernie Sanders exceeded expectations when it came to African-American voters. Mm-hmm. That he didn't win them outright, but he did better than all the projections. And that was a big, winning big among African-American voters was a big part of the Hillary Clinton strategy.
Well, we know Hillary Clinton yesterday still walked away with way more delegates than Senator Sanders. But what
overall when all the primaries are
exactly
counted.
Not just in, but overall
Mississippi, yeah. Michigan,
Mississippi,
yep.
the, yes. Mm-hmm. But what does Michigan tell the Clinton campaign?
That as she heads into the more industrial states, remember the last southern state has voted now. As she heads into the more industrial states, she had better pay closer attention, matching Bernie Sanders' populist message when it comes to income inequality and free trade agreements.
And I think we're, you know, Ohio is the next, you know, really big Midwestern state. That's next Tuesday. Polling there recently had her up 30
and don't forget
points.
Illinois.
And Illinois, mm-hmm. you know, more, you know, working class, Midwestern, Rust Belt, up 30 points latest polls. Believe you me that folks are going to be looking at that polls again and saying, okay, A, did we get those a little wrong? And B, what kind of momentum do voters in the Midwest mm-hmm. see from Bernie winning? Go, hey, maybe this guy has a chance. I want to try and do this.
Let's talk about the mm-hmm. GOP and John Kasich, as mm-hmm. you mentioned, Ohio, because it's been very clear that's a must do for him as much as Florida is for Marco Rubio. What did
absolutely.
Michigan say to everybody who is not Donald Trump in the GOP?
I think they said, eh.
Well,
I mean, look, Kasich needed to come in second and a decisive second mm-hmm. in Michigan to keep, you know, this same sort of narrative that Hillary Clinton had or was hoping to have, which is, you know, I am from, you know, the Midwest goes for me. Rust Belt, middle income, white voters, Kasich, and also Barnes. I mean, he was here this week and still came in third, though, given, I mean, almost he was Cruz 24.9, Kasich 24.2. So, I mean, almost a virtual tie. But
yeah,
he
I think
really
it was a virtual
to win second place in Michigan to have a narrative going forward. And he didn't.
Well, I'll quibble with that.
Sure.
I think that he can claim that narrative going forward. However, it is interesting that John Kasich said if he had spent any more time in Michigan, he'd have to start paying taxes here.
Yes.
And there's some truth to that. And so what does it say that Kasich practically lived in Michigan in the week leading up to the primary? Ted Cruz made barely a stop in the state, once in Grand Rapids and once at the debate in Detroit. And yet they both had virtually the same result. That's got to be giving the Kasich campaign some pause.
Right, exactly. That's my point. And quickly, Cindy, just to have this note, though, as we're talking about Trump, the big winner, Sanders, mm-hmm. the big winner out of Michigan, Trump got, and, you know, we're still counting official votes, but 481,000 votes. Top that with Bernie Sanders, 592,000. So when you're looking at actual votes, Sanders over 100,000, Hillary Clinton 572,000, so about 90,000. So both Democratic candidates, both still
individually
getting more votes than Trump.
Think we could see a Clinton-Sanders ticket in November?
Oh my gosh, no. Your thoughts?
I want to say that
that's
choosing choosing running mates is such alchemy that I wouldn't want to venture a guess this far out. But the other thing is, how much is she really going to need him on the ticket? Because no matter what, if she is the nominee, and I think that's still the expectation, that Sanders is going to come out strong for her as a far and away better alternative to whoever the Republicans nominate. Yeah. So I don't think she's going to have to worry about some kind of a Sanders effect, except that, you know, there will be some people who are disappointed that the progressive populist didn't get the nomination.
Breaking down the Michigan primary with our It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta. As always, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Two.
You, Cindy.
My pleasure.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. One of the key elements of the Flint water crisis was a federal emergency declaration from President Obama. Let's look at the process of what it takes to get a federal disaster declaration, an emergency declaration, and figure it all out as we welcome Daniel Vaak, who's a reporter for Governing. Good to have you with us, Dan.
Great to be here.
As we know, President Obama approved Governor Snyder's request for that federal emergency declaration, which allowed up to $5 million in federal funding without congressional approval. But he denied Governor Snyder's request for a disaster declaration. Can you tell us more about the difference between emergency declaration and disaster declaration?
Like it sounds, it's something very quick and imminent. It's not nearly as robust. You know, you can declare an emergency declaration before, say, a hurricane lands or snow starts falling in preparation for things. Disaster declarations are, again, a lot more robust. They require the state to sort of give a damage assessment. So there's a lot more involved in the application for the disaster declaration, but there's also more sort of tools that the federal government can bring, and they last longer.
So more money available. So we think of something like a Hurricane Sandy or a Hurricane Katrina.
Exactly. And in those cases, though, remember, there's an emergency declaration declared first.
Right.
But after the, you know, kind of hurricane or superstorm came through, then there were also disaster declarations that followed.
And we know that Governor Snyder, you know, is trying to appeal the denials as far as the disaster declaration. Is there a formula that FEMA uses to calculate all of this besides just kind of a subjective impression? Is there actually a formula?
Well, there are several criteria. The one that is probably the most relevant in Michigan in this case is the law that governs all of this, called the Stafford Act, actually says what types of events qualify for disaster. And they're basically all sorts of natural disasters or fires, whether or not they were natural or not. It does not include anything that would allow for, you know, lead poisoning or, you know, lead in the water. That is actually why FEMA has rejected it. Now, there's other sort of criteria, how much it costs, how much the state has put up, what the damage is, how much insurance was, that type of deal, that all go into the sort of calculation that's all laid out in the law. But in this case, the exception that they're relying on is just there's no category for it in the law that authorizes the disaster declarations.
And speaking of that Stafford Act, Dan, you know, clearly the Flint water crisis was man-made, doesn't qualify because it wasn't a natural disaster or fire and explosion. But we think of terrorist attacks, train derailments, chemical spills, and, of course, lead poisoning in drinking water. We got to wonder, is the standard laid out in the Stafford Act adequate for our 21st century realities?
Well, I think there's a lot of debate about that. I mean, there's a lot in the Stafford Act. I think that it got a lot more scrutiny after the terrorist attacks in 2001, after Hurricane Katrina, you know, Hurricane Sandy. You know, every time there's a major disaster, there's sort of this reevaluation of, you know, what exactly the Stafford Act requires. And some of these things, too, I mean, this happens in states with governors of both parties that, you know, it kind of left scratching their heads, you know, why did we get a declaration for this but not for that? It's fair to say that there's a lot of questions about the Stafford Act. They come up quite frequently, but it's also a pretty thorny issue once you get into, you know, how do you define a disaster? And that's probably why it hasn't been clarified as much recently.
Can you give us a sense, Dan, how tough it is for governors to get disaster declarations? Because we know other governors have
as you said, left scratching their heads, wondering why this and not that. We know of an algae bloom, for instance, in Massachusetts that was denied. And we're having similar problems in Lake Erie. Can you give us some examples that illuminate the difficulty of winning these declarations?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that's worth keeping in mind is that most of the time, I mean, the vast majority of the time, there is no difficulty, right? I mean, so it's sort of the borderline cases that, and governors may not call them borderline cases, but most of the time when governors look for assistance, FEMA and the president will oblige. So, for example, a few years back, there was a fire in Arizona, and I don't know if you remember this one, but 19 firefighters had died in a small town. It was a huge fire, but part of the calculations is how much the state can afford, you know, what's the economic impact. And so they went through those sort of calculations, and they decided that even though it was a terrible tragedy, it didn't actually qualify as a disaster under the Stafford Act. Now, at about the same time in Texas, they had a chemical plant that exploded in a town called West. Initially, the federal government denied the disaster declaration. And then Governor Perry of Texas, you know, made a lot of speeches, and a lot of people in Congress did, and, you know, their emergency management agency, you know, re-looked at their application. They appealed, and they actually won an appeal. It doesn't happen all that often, but this was kind of one of those where the dollar thresholds and all those things were pretty close. And so, you know, the president had also gone to West Texas and stood at the site and said, we're going to come help you. And, you know, the governor then asked, well, if you're going to help us, why don't you give us a disaster declaration? So I think there is some subjectivity there. But a lot of times, you know, it comes down to what can the state afford? Is it really a crisis that's beyond the state capability that the federal government needs to step in with these types of assistance?
Being, Dan, that we're in the heat of an election year and right now, you know, primary action in Michigan this week, I have to ask the question, what about the role of politics in either asking for a disaster declaration or granting it?
Well, one thing that we have seen historically, this hasn't actually didn't happen in the last couple election cycles, but for decades before that, we saw that the number of disaster declarations that governors had asked for from the president always spiked in presidential election years. And I don't know that anybody's come up with a really good reason as to why that is. Maybe they felt like presidents were under more scrutiny and more likely to give them a favorable reading. But what I did find by going back through that is it was actually the spike in number of disaster declarations was because governors had been asking more often. It wasn't because the president suddenly got, you know, more generous in the presidential election year and decided to grant more or a higher percentage of the applications.
Fair enough. Well, finally, Dan, in your view, since you've looked at other emergencies and other disasters in other states, what do you think is the most likely way forward for Governor Rick Snyder in getting more federal dollars for Flint?
Well, you know, I mean, just remember that this is a small portion of the overall sort of federal response. I mean, there's different pots of money coming from the federal government. First of all, the disaster declaration denial was appealed, and he lost. So there's not really much to go forward from there. Mm-hmm. Whether or not his, I'm not sure what will happen with his emergency appeal to try to get more relief under the emergency declaration. But I think, you know, remember there's a bill in Congress that also has substantial relief for Flint.
Which so is up, I being think, held up right now by Senator Mike Lee.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So there's a lot of different avenues for him to pursue. I think, you know, he's pursuing, you know, every avenue that he can, which is what I think you would expect from most governors when they're facing a crisis like this.
Daniel Vok is a reporter for Governing. Great talking with you, Dan. Thank you very, very much for your time.
Sure. Thanks for having me on.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Cass Adair, Mike Blank, Josh Hakala, Sean McHenry, and Mercedes Mejia. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.